This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul. This is your HedgeGhoul Master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. This podcast, we'll be looking at Kildare in the revolutionary decade. While not in the vanguard of armed activity during the War of Independence, Kildare was central to the revolutionary decade as a whole, not only for its strategic importance and proximity to Dublin, but in particular as the site of the largest British military establishment at the Curragh. It also has the dubious distinction of being the county worst affected by the food pandemic of 1918-1919. And to discuss these and related matters, we're joined by James Durney, author of, amongst others, In a Time of War, Kildare, 1914 to 1918. A regular History Ireland HedgeGhoul panellist, John Gibney, assistant editor of the Royal Irish Academy's Documents on Irish Foreign Policy series. Ida Milne, author of Stacking the Coffins, Influenza, War and Revolution in Ireland, 1918 to 1919. And finally, Fionnuala Walsh, author of Irish Women and the Great War. And this podcast is supported by Kildare County Council's Decade of Commemorations programme and the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Now, John Gibney, can I go to you? Because in other HedgeGhouls we've done, one of the things that's always a factor is the historical background. And Kildare is a strange kind of a place in a sense. It's kind of on the edge, but in the middle, if you like, you know, in many ways. But going back into the sort of early modern period, Kildare at an earlier period was a centre of power and of course was later a centre of rebellion. Just talk to us a little bit about that sort of background.
Well, if you're going to touch upon that kind of background, it touches upon what, you know, one of the probably most crucial attributes of that Kildare has geographically, which is that, as you say, it's pretty central. It's also quite large. And you mentioned its role as a centre of power going back centuries into the Middle Ages. In medieval and early modern Ireland, you know, the Fitzgerald Earls of Kildare were one of the most important aristocratic families in the country, up until the 16th century, very often holding the most senior offices in the land. And their power, I suppose, essentially came from geography. Their power base centred on the modern county of Kildare. It would have been on the edges of what was then the English Pale. So you're talking about, you know, a region that was a frontier region at that time. If you fast forward a little bit to, say, even 1798, I mean, we don't think of Kildare automatically in terms of the 1798 rebellion. You know, Connacht and Wexford tend to take precedent in people's perceptions of 1798. But there was a very, very long, powerful, sustained, two-month-long insurgency in Kildare, which saw attacks across the county break out pretty much as soon as the rebellion began. And I suppose it goes back to what the plan in 1798 was of a rebellion starting in Dublin and emanating out through the counties adjacent to Dublin before hopefully becoming into, you know, morphing into more, I suppose, a national uprising. Now, none of that necessarily proves anything in relation to the 20th century, because, I mean, I think the point is made by Marie Coleman that if activity in 1798 is a bellwether, well, I mean, it doesn't really prove anything, because Wexford isn't the most exactly, was not the most active county during the War of Independence. If you're going to use those kind of historic examples, though, to illustrate points that might come through in a discussion of the modern era, it relates back to the location of Kildare, its size, its geography, its centrality. The British base at the Curragh will loom large in the discussion, and there's no coincidence that the Curragh is located within Kildare in such a, you know, a geographically central and therefore strategically important region. One thing that might be worth throwing in there as well would be, you know, the Nationalist and Republican pilgrimage to Wolfetone's grave at Bowdenstown that emerged from the late 19th century onwards. Now, very often, those pilgrimages were essentially kind of day trips or dubs, you know, travelling out of the city very often. But it does, I suppose, indicate a kind of, you know, it's another aspect of Kildare's politics that, you know, is perhaps worth throwing into the discussion as well. But the key thing you would take from all those historic examples is the location of the county, its size, and its importance to the point of view of those who actually ran Ireland up until independence.
Ida, you want to come in on that?
Yes, to add to what John's been talking about, there's also the really strong connection to the establishment. And this is something I'm very aware of as somebody who lives right in the heart of Big House territory in Strafford Clock in North Kildare. I'm surrounded by, for example, Bishop's Court, which was the home of the Ponsonbys, who were really, really well connected over several centuries into the political life of Britain and Ireland. John Ponsonby was Speaker of the Irish House of Commons between 1753 and 1761. William Ponsonby was leader of the Irish Whigs. And then, you know, other members of the family were also well connected in over several generations. In Lyons House, we have the Lawless family. Lawless may or may not have been involved in the United Irish. It's still a question mark over it, but was also involved in things like the Landlords Association. And even in 1913, little Mary Lawless famously drove her cow into Dublin to feed the starving during the lockout. Her father gave it to her on condition that she actually drove it herself and thought she wouldn't, but of course she did. So then we have the Bartons locally, and then the Mayos, for example, and of course the Connollys in Castletown. So you have this enormous, very powerful milieu all over North Kildare, and not only powerful politically, but also economically strong in really, really good farming territory. And I think that all adds a background. And of course, the local newspaper, the Kildare Observer, is a Castle paper. And it's feeding in as a local paper into this great and good of Irish society, which I think creates a very unique atmosphere locally compared to, you know, you have all these really powerful, well-connected Irish families here.
And what were landlord-tenant relations like in Kildare, just, you know, in the say, late 19th, early 20th century?
They tended to be relatively good. I mean, there had been issues with Lawless, for example, you know, because of associations with the landlord associations. But they tended, because they created very stable economic societies, and disruption is often, as you know, John was mentioning Wexford being an outlier in 1798, and that is probably something to do with the fact that the price of grain dropped drastically in the couple of years before the rebellion. But if you have stable societies and stable economies, people tend not to rise.
Now, James, I wanted to go to you just to sketch the sort of the economy, the society. But just before I go to that, James, in terms of this historical background, right? I take what Renee Coleman says that doesn't necessarily determine what happens. But in terms of propaganda, or the sense that people have that the Kildare volunteers or nationalists, whether constitutional or revolutionary, would have of themselves, did that background feature a lot?
Well, just going back to what John was saying about 1798 and that, and of course Kildare doesn't really factor in much of the talking about the 1798 rebellion, but it was quite open rebellion in Kildare in 1798, which did last up until around 1815. And Kildare was spoken of as one of the most disaffected counties in the country because of the 98 rebellion, the Emmet rebellion then, which a lot of Kildaremen participated in. And right up to the 1820s, Kildare was very, very rebellious, which leads then to how Kildare becomes a garrison county, because the British Army decided that to control the roads leading south and west would be a good idea then was to build permanent military settlements all along these roads. And of course, the first one is built at Naas Barracks in 1815, and this was to accommodate 300 men. It eventually becomes home to the Royal Dublin Fusiliers. Further along then, a couple of years later, Newbridge Barracks was built, and this was a cavalry barracks with up to 1,000 horses, 800 men then as well. There had been no town in Newbridge. Newbridge never existed until the army barracks was built, and then the town springs up around it. In 1855 then, the largest military base in Ireland is built under Curragh Plains, which would eventually accommodate 6,000 men, and at times of war during World War I had 10,000 men there as well. So in 1901 then, an artillery barracks was built in Kildare town with accommodation for 1,000 men. So this was all able to control the roads leading south and west. And eventually, because of this, Kildare becomes tied to the British military presence economically through its trade, and then loyalty through the integration of the military with the civilian population.
What size, can you put a figure on it, James, roughly, say that the pre-First World War, how many military were located there, roughly?
Well, we're talking about 6,000 troops. In the population of Kildare in 1911 is 66,627, of which 54,684 are Catholic, 11,943 are Protestants. So Kildare's Protestant population stands at 15.7%, which is above the national average of 13.3%, which bodes well for British Army recruitment. The population was the military population was the highest in the country, and pre-war stood at nearly 6,000.
10% then, 10% roughly.
Yes, with 4,500 at the Curragh, 800 in Newbridge, 600 in Kildare, and 150 in Naas.
Now, Fionnuala, can I bring you in? Because in terms of the all this military presence, there was an informal economy as well. I'm referring to the Wrens of the Curragh. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I guess often where you have soldiers, you have informal networks of prostitution. And so around the garrison areas of Kildare, they're developed what were known as Wrens. So women who effectively made their living from interactions with the soldiers. And so there's a particular group of these in the 19th century around the Curragh. These were groups of women that lived together, had their own sort of social support system, very much looking after each other, and existed in a sort of transactional relationship with the local soldiers. They would move on when pressed to do so by the authorities. They're kind of come back again and, sort of transient population in a sense. Some of them living in very, very poor conditions, living with children in quite grim conditions. But this was very much sort of tolerated to some degree until there was concern then in the late 19th century about spread of syphilis, particularly spread of venereal diseases. And so contagious diseases acts were brought in, which caused a lot of opposition from the suffrage movement and feminist campaigners, and because these penalised women for their interactions with soldiers. And so this led to some more attempts to control these women's behaviour. But they continued to, in the 1880s, 1890s, there continued to be these local networks, these women, effectively living in these quite basic conditions on the edges of the camps.
Now, listen, James, I just want to go back just to move the discussion on a little bit, right, to the period before the First World War, right, and the formation of the Irish Volunteers, right, because obviously then the Irish Volunteers are up against the British Army in terms of, like, who is going to recruit who. So how did they fare in Kildare?
Well, the first volunteer companies are formed in Kildare in early 1914, but Kildare men have been active in the Irish Volunteers right from the beginning, because the famous Frank Burke footballer that the Dubs are claiming all the time actually come from Carberry, and him and his brother were at the formation of the Irish Volunteers in Dublin in 1913. There was also another guy from Kilcock, Patrick O'Keefe, who was also involved in the Volunteers from as early as the beginning of the Volunteers. So from early 1914, the Irish Volunteers begin to form in Kildare. Naas, of course, is one of the first Irish Volunteer companies formed. Eventually, there's around 6,000 men in the Irish Volunteers in 1914, just prior to the opening of the First World War.
So that's equal to the British.
That's presence. Equal to British recruiting. Unfortunately, most of them head off to the British Army then when John Redmond asks for volunteers. So the bulk of them, the majority of them, join the British Army. And you're left then with a couple of hundred who formed the Irish Volunteers who reorganized then in early 1915 and then began to organize for a rebellion in 1916.
Now, Fionnuala, what about common man in Kildare?
Yeah, so there's a branch of Cumannamon founded in Naas in late July 1914. So it founded to assist the local Irish volunteers. And the first meeting of them is reported in great detail in the Leinster Leader at the time. Elizabeth Bloxham comes down from the central branch in Dublin, speaks to the branch, calling on the women to live for their country, doing their duty day in and day out, saying it's harder than to die for one's country. And the meeting is chaired by the local parish priest, Father Norris. And again, you know, there's a lot of support for the organisation locally. There's also branches in Attai as well at the time. But of course, this is on the eve of the First World War. This is when there's still concern about, you know, possible outbreak of civil war on the island. And so Cumannamon, you know, doesn't really, it splinters very much after the outbreak of war. The central branch in Dublin decides to oppose Irish involvement in the war, to oppose John Redmond's stance on joining the British Army, saying that the men should stay at home. But the local branches down the country, most of them support Redmond. And so they basically dissolve, become nursing corps, Red Cross organizations, you know, branches to support the volunteers. And this is what happens in Kildare. So it
mirrors the split in the volunteer organization.
It does. It's a little bit confusing because the central branch takes the opposite response. But ultimately, like with the volunteers, most of the membership end up in organizations to support the war effort. So in Athy and Naas, they declared the support for Redmond and their opposition to central branch, and they established a nursing corps instead. So for 1914, 1915, Cumannamon, you know, basically disappears in Kildare. But as it does in the rest of the country, you know, there's a revival in 1916 after the Easter Rising, and they are become apparent again with the anti-conscription campaign in 1918. And, you know, I found military service pension claims from women in Kildare who certainly assert that they were involved with Cumannamon right from 1914 onwards. But this does seem to have been quite a small number of women. Far more, of course, were involved in activities to support the war effort in the various different organisations on the home front.
Okay, James, can I go back to you on the war? Now, I'm assuming the war had a huge impact on Kildare, I mean, in terms of recruitment. So where did Kildare fit in terms of British Army recruitment, I mean, comparatively with the rest of the country?
They're a little bit higher than a lot of the other counties per head of population. And again, recruitment is quite high in Kildare because you have the Dublin Fusiliers based in Naas Barracks. So if you wanted to actually join a regiment of your choice, you go to Naas. If you wanted to join the artillery, you go to Kildare. If you want to join the cavalry, you go to Newbridge. If you want to join any service, you go to the Curra. So there's a huge amount of people coming into the county that are not from the county, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So they're recruiting from all over the country. The Royal Dublin Fusiliers recruit from Dublin, Kildare, Wicklow and Meath. All those areas are for the Dublin Fusiliers. And then the rest of the country is accommodated through the other branches of service and that. So there is a huge amount of recruitment in County Kildare, but not as much as the British Army expects. And this is where recruitment in Ireland never really is on a par as it is in Scotland, England and Wales. And it's mainly the labouring classes, those that don't have any work because there's no big industry in County Kildare. Most of the work is through farming. There's about 12,000 people employed in farming and a lot of the others are employed on the land of the estates, the big estates around the county. And then, of course, the British Army barracks have a huge amount of civilians working in the camps or providing food and fodder to horses and men in the camps as well. So the whole economy.
Presumably, this caused a huge, is it a big economic boom for the county in general?
Oh yeah, in general, like the farmers make a lot of money in Kildare and throughout the whole country. And the British are always complaining that there's not enough farmer's sons going to fight in the British Army, that it's all the labouring classes. And the middle classes and the farming class are not contributing enough recruits. Right up to 1918, this is a complaint. And of course, why should a farmer send his son off to fight in a foreign war when he can make plenty of money and stay at home? And there's plenty of others who are going to do the fighting for them. So it's really the labouring classes, the ones that don't have any work, that actually go to join the British Army. And that's always been the way it has been anyway.
Would they not be subject to a contradictory pull, right? Either to join the British Army, but presumably there's plenty of work for farm labourers.
Yeah, well, that's it too. Like, I mean, you know, the British are looking for recruits and yet they want plenty of food. And Ireland supplies an awful lot of food to the British Army as well. They supply loads of horses as well. There's something like 300,000 horses go from Ireland to Britain to serve in the war. And of course, Kildare, being synonymous with horse breeding, there's plenty of horses sold in Kildare. I remember coming across a case that one fella said he sold a nag to the British Army for £45, which was a huge amount of money at the time. So they were taking up every type of horse available. Even Jarvies were selling the horses. There was that many horses sold in the county that there wasn't enough horses to do any ploughing, and they had to introduce tractors, which was a new invention, and tractors have appeared in the landscape of Kildare during the war. So it's a great time for farming. It's a great time for shopkeepers supplying, and pubs, of course, do a roaring trade, supplying all the troops, and of course the separation women with plenty of booze while the men are away fighting and that. So there's a lot of money made in Kildare during the war.
But yeah, just go back to the farm labourers, right? Because this is the period when the Irish Transport and General Workers Union were making big inroads in unionising farm labourers. How did that project go in Kildare?
Well, in Selbridge, there was a strike started for better pay and better working conditions. And a strike began in Selbridge. I think 60 men were locked out by the farmers' union. And it begins a dispute then that spreads through the Midlands area to Meath and all around County Kildare. And it's a kind of dispute between the farmers' union and the Irish Transport and General Workers' Union, who were looking after the farm labourers. And this strike goes on until the end of August, when negotiations then sort out working times and pay. But the police are brought in. The farmers' union asked for the police for protection, because there's a lot of harassment going on, as offending farms are blockaded and strikers wielding clubs prevented the movement of goods, disruptive fairs and auctions, engaged in cattle drives and damaged crops. No market produce was delivered or anything because of the strike, and that 1,000 men were thrown out of work. So if the farmers look for the police to come in to protect them, where the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, which many of the labourers are members of, both members of the union and members of maybe the IRA or the Labour Party or something like that, and these look for help from the Republicans. So local Republicans send in volunteers to police disputes then as well.
But that means then that there's a large number of people, talking about farm labourers here, who are predisposed to not take kindly to the RIC. Do you know what I mean? Regardless of the national question, right? In other words, there is an oppositional posture there from the get-go. So you got, am I right in that?
Yeah.
And it seems to me then that there's a sort of a contradiction, because Ida was talking about the social deference on one hand. So it's a very much a mixed bag, you know, of a mixture of social deference in one way, but quite a radical politics bubbling under the surface in another way.
Yeah, in the lower classes as such.
At a lower level, yeah.
Yeah, where most of the, British Army recruitment is in the lower classes and in the upper classes because of the landed gentry. Most of these go to the British Army and end up getting killed. A lot of the labouring classes, and again, of course, it's the middle classes, the shopkeepers, all those that don't want to fight. And I mean, who could blame them? They don't want to fight in Britain's war, but they're no problem taking money off the British government in any way.
Just, I'll come back to the second gen. So I just want to go to Fionnuala here, because there's one kind of unique aspect of the First World War. That is the presence of Belgian refugees in Selbridge. Fionnuala, how did these Belgians end up in Selbridge?
Yeah, so when the war, due to the invasion of Belgium, there was a need, of course, for Belgians to be accommodated. And so most of them ended up in Britain. But there was a kind of an understanding that the Belgians were mostly Catholic, and so that they would be they'd be particularly at home in Ireland, and that there would be particular support for them here. So over the course of the war, 3,000 Belgians arrive in Ireland and are accommodated here. And what's really interesting about this is the level of hospitality towards them and the level of interest shown by the local community. So in Selbridge, for example, they learn quite early on in the war that there's going to be, that the workhouse in Selbridge is going to be used for hosting Belgian refugees. And so this was, you know, this is largely due to its proximity to Dublin. They were looking for boards of guardians of unions within easy reach Dublin to use initially as sort of receiving depots for the refugees. So the first refugees arrive in Selbridge in late October 1914, 36 of them arriving. And, you know, it's very obvious from the newspaper reports at the time, just the extent of the welcome that was given to them by the local population. You know, people were very excited about this. Apparently there were Belgian flags and evidence everywhere, and there were welcoming parties for them. And it's made very clear that they were not to be treated as paupers in the workhouse, they were to be seen as guests. So they were given different clothes to the usual inhabitants, different food, you know, different rules were accorded to them. Now the numbers in Selbridge keep changing as some of them come and then they get moved on to places like Dunshaughlin, for example, and then they're replaced by other ones. But, you know, in total there's around 60 of them that are hosted in Selbridge. Now it's only really between October 1914 and around March 1915 before they're ultimately consolidated at Dunshaughlin. But during that time, they're really embedded in the local community. So shortly after they arrived, there's a wedding between two of the refugees. And this is given, you know, a lot of reporting in the papers, the locals come out to support it. And another refugee passes away in early 1915 while living in the workhouse. And again, he's buried in Dunacrum Cemetery in support that his funeral adheres to Belgian funeral customs. And again, the local population come out to support them. And, you know, they really see the Belgians as part of their community at the time. And apparently, now this is again, you know, newspaper reporting, you know, we have to take it with a grain of salt, but they were apparently really regretted having to move on from Selbridge. And they were, one of them apparently ran away and tried to come back to Selbridge, wanting to stay there. And apparently they were very grateful for their treatment in Selbridge.
Yeah, James, can I go back to you on the, because I just wanted to talk about the 1916 rising, because Kildare is not a million miles away from Dublin. So now nothing happened in Kildare, but there was an involvement, was there not?
Yeah, well, there was a plan for about 150 volunteers. GHQ had planned that 150 volunteers would assemble in Kildare and it would destroy the railway bridge and communications in around the Salins area to halt British reinforcements coming from the Curragh to Dublin on the outbreak of the rising. Of course, because of the countermanding order, a lot of things got mixed up and only a few men assembled. A lot of the companies, there was a couple of, you know, there was over a half dozen companies in Naas that were kind of a little bit under strength, but there was a few men available. They all mobilized and then demobilized when the countermanding order came through. But in minute, Donal O'Buchla, who was the officer commanding Minute Volunteers, who had formed the Minute Volunteers, he happened to be speaking to a bread man on that morning, and he had said that the rising had broken out in Dublin. So O'Buchla, who at the time, I think, was 55 or thereabouts, he cycled into Dublin from Minute, which is 15 miles, tried to get to volunteer headquarters, couldn't get through because of the fighting and that, and then cycled back to Minute. He then organised his volunteer company to go back into Dublin, and he got about 14 men. Now, Ted O'Kelly had come along, and the Boer Burn who had been a veteran of the Boer War, he had been an organizer in Kildare as well. So he and Ted O'Kelly and Donal O'Buchla led about a dozen men into Maynooth, or into Dublin from Maynooth. They walked the whole way using the railway line as a guide, and arrived in Dublin on Tuesday, Easter Tuesday morning, to take part in the Rising. So they walked down from the top of O'Connell Street down to the GPO, where they're greeted at the door by James Connolly and Padraig Pearce. Connolly doles out cigars to the men, and they send them down to have a cup of tea and a bun, and then they're sent off to fight in Parliament Street, where British troops are launching attacks from Dublin Castle. So they end up fighting in Dublin for the whole of Easter week. But while they're in there, they meet many more Kildare men, including Frank Burke, who we were talking about earlier, the footballer. He's there, and his sister, Ava Burke, is a nurse in the GPO. She actually nurses James Connolly when he's wounded. And there's Kildare men fighting all over Dublin during the Rising, including those who come from Newbridge and the Corrie camp as reinforcements, because the bridge is not blown at Salins, and the reinforcements arrive in Dublin from the Corrie camp within 5 hours. This is one of the reasons why the Rising fails, because British reinforcements arrive so quickly.
Now, given the importance of the British military establishment in the county, right, what was the response, what was the public opinion response to the Rising?
Well, the public opinion is mainly that was really against the Rising, and even Kildare County Council and all those, they condemned the Rising as well. In general, most people are against the Rising, and we have to remember that at that same week at Hulluch, the Royal Dublin Fusiliers are attacked by the Germans. Now, they've only arrived, 8th and 9th Battalions have only arrived at the front, and it's a gas attack. There's 700 Irishmen killed in that week of Easter week, and many of those are from Kildare. Many of them are from Dublin and that. So there's really no sympathy for the rebels in County Kildare, and again in Dublin as well, there's very little sympathy. But of course, we know that all changes then within a couple of weeks.
Now, just go back to the war, forget about the Rising for a minute, right? What sort of casualties then did Kildare, these Kildare recruits suffer in the war? And how does it compare with the national average?
Well, it's pretty high compared to the national average. And I think recruitment per head of population is only behind Dublin in recruitment. And in total, about, say, 745 men from Kildare were killed. Two women also died serving with the nurse's aide in the war as well. So it's quite high. Now, there is a bit of a thing countrywide with counties over-exaggerating casualty figures for each county. And this is because, how do you determine what a Kildare man is? I mean, a lot of the people that we would have on a list of Kildare dead would be born in the Corrie of English or Scottish or Welsh parents, might only be in the county for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, but yet they're born in County Kildare. So maybe 100 of those casualties were not resident in Kildare, if you know what I mean. And there's others that might have been born in Kerry or might have been born in Wicklow, had been living in Kildare all their lives. So that's how discrepancies come up in how many people from each county. And it's hard to determine exactly how many people from each county were killed. But we've come up with a figure of about 745 for County Kildare.
Now, James, would I be right in assuming that relatively high death rate would have been the factor that would have fueled the opposition to conscription rather than reaction to the 1916 Rising?
Yeah, well, it's that, and it's the casualty list. If you look at the Kildare Observer, the Leinster Leader, every time there's a major battle, you have casualty lists in the newspapers, and it's the killed and wounded and missing. And these casualty lists are huge, especially after battles like Gallipoli or the Somme or anything like that. This is going to deter people from joining the British Army. Plus the fact that men are coming back, coughing up their lungs, or they're coming back minus a leg or an arm. This deters recruitment as much as the Easter Rising or conscription. And it's when...
And was recruitment... I mean, because I think we now know that recruitment in general was dipping well before the 1916 rising anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that the pattern in Kildare?
The same pattern in Kildare. Recruitment is falling. And it's then that, you know, they're talking about... people are going out. Some of the gentry are going out trying to recruit people for the British Army. And that was a woman from out this direction there, Mrs. Spooner, went around trying to find out why men were not joining the British Army and all that. One fella said that he was afraid of bullets and bayonets and he wasn't going to go. Another fella said that he was working. Why should he go off and get killed in France? So generally the consensus is that, you know, recruitment is fallen. At one recruiting meeting in, I think it was in Carberry, one recruit was all they got. And despite all the dignitaries out asking for recruits, only one person stepped forward. So recruitment is falling before the rising.
Now, as we get towards the end of the war, right, another factor in all of this is the flu pandemic, Ida. And this is something that it really, until your book came along, really wasn't really properly explored at all. But Ida, Kildare was one of the worst affected counties from this. Now, why was that? Just talk to us about that, how the flu affected Kildare.
Well, anywhere that there are unusual factors, when an epidemic comes along, they will exacerbate the rate of death. So unusual movements of people or things like fuel supply, that kind of thing, was affected. So County Kildare has the highest death rate per 1,000 living out of that population of 66,000 that we mentioned earlier in 1918. And it has the highest rate of death per 1,000 living at 3.95 per 1,000 living. And it gives it a kind of an unusual, sorry, I'm being a bit confusing here, an unusual trophy, I suppose. But the real reason behind that is Naas, the town of Naas. And it has an open pail system, which means that people are coming out with emptying the contents of their chamber pots into buckets and then bringing them out into the local dung heap. And that's one factor. And, you know, for another reason, not just that it's, you know, that it, that could be actually infecting it, but that they're congregating to do that. But the other factors was that water supply to the town was really dodgy in those years. And it could be cut off for several hours during the day. And the third factor then is that the Naas Gas Company got infected by the flu and power went down in the town for days at a time. And it affected the printing of the local newspapers, it affected the local businesses, but it also affected heat and light to the houses. Which, of course, you know, if you're treating people with the flu, they need hot water to make things like poultices. They also need stuff like hot, nourishing gruel to help them to get through it. And I suppose two hot whiskies are a great help to do that. So that is really, I think, the key reason. Even though people talk about it being the factor of the army being at the Curragh, in fact, the flu was quite low, relatively low, lower than you would expect amongst the army, so much so that they were able to send their doctors out into the community to help them in the local towns.
People listening are familiar with the fact that these kind of pandemics come in waves, Ida. So when did it affect it? When did these different waves affect the country?
There were three key waves of the flu in Ireland. The first one is in July 1918. Quite a mild wave, and it's spoken of as being that affects the kind of north quarter of the country from Ulster right down as far as Kildare and Dublin. The second wave then, which is really the key for Kildare and for most of Leinster, is in October through December 1918. And then it comes back again in another really nasty wave in February through April of 1919. And at that stage, in the middle of 1919, I've mapped it, flu deaths forwards to 1925. And it just flatlines after that. The line just flattens after that. Flu becomes part of the seasonal flu from then until the 1950s.
Tell me, Ida, there's very little. I get the impression that people didn't regard this the way we're looking, you know, the COVID pandemic at the moment. I mean, would I be right in saying that people were used to the idea of periodic pandemics and infectious diseases of one sort or another, that they just would shrug their shoulders and accept it as just one of those things?
Absolutely. I think this is one thing that makes the flu so fascinating, is that we had a different way of seeing history until recent years. And therefore, we didn't have this lens where we could actually identify it as a topic worthy of study. So pandemics and epidemics were really a normal thing. We had had a pandemic in the 1890s, the Russian flu. But also, we remember in the 19th century, we'd had things like pandemics of cholera. We had three, perhaps four of them infecting here, but they traveled around the world. We tend to think of them as being just associated with us and the famines. But they traveled right around the world. There was also, when an army would venture abroad, they would always come back bringing diseases with them. And the British War Office were really looking keenly at Ireland and Britain to see were there unusual epidemics or unusual outbreaks of disease within the civilian population. They were monitoring it really closely and getting reports from all around the countries on it, on both islands on it. But I think, Tommy, you know, one of the really key reasons to why we didn't see this as a topic worthy of study until more recent years, when Katrina Foley, Patricia Marsh and myself began looking at it, was that disease impacted on every family in the 1910s, even though the picture had improved vastly over the previous 50 years. Typically in the 1910s, the whole island had 70,000 plus deaths per year. Now we'd have about 32,000 deaths plus per year. And many of those deaths came from infectious diseases and from diseases that are now treatable by vaccination and by antibiotics. So you would have things like bronchitis, pneumonia, and TB killing in the thousand each year. And you would have diseases like whooping cough, measles, scarlet fever, killing in the hundreds each year. And the statistic that really shocks me of all those statistics is that 20% of those 70,000 plus deaths each year were of children under the age of five.
Right.
So death of small children was really, really common in Irish families at the time. And so to me, the big flu was just one more noise in a really loud cacophony of a death by infectious disease.
Now, I just find this wrapped in this book. What was the political impact of the flu?
There's a fascinating parallel between the flu and the German plot. We talked about conscription earlier and the anti-conscription campaigns. And when the British administration trumped up this idea of a new German plot, a new insurrection being fueled by Germany, they rounded up the great and the good of Irish society, including, I think it was the O'Connors as well. James will correct me there. The prominent Kildare political family, but they rounded them up. There's about 70 or so of them. They come and go. The number is very, very hard to define. And they're brought away in May 1918 under the Defence of the Realm regulations. They're brought and interned in Britain. And of course, Sinn Féin and other organisations immediately adopt this into their propaganda and start saying, look, you know, these people have suffered enough already. Many of them have been previously incarcerated. Their health could be definitely in question if anything happens when they're away. And then, lo and behold, happens, the flu comes along and plays right into the hands of Sinn Féin. And they're able to promote this through their propaganda all the time. And you see this being fed by people like Miss O'Connor, the sister of Art O'Connor, who was writing to the newspapers and to other people talking about, you know, the danger that will come if our men come down with the flu. So in this group that's interned in Britain, you have people like De Valera, you have people like Arthur Griffith, you have Maud Gonne, you have Kathleen Clarke and Constance Markovitch. So the really key people in the movement and in the anti-conscription movement and in nationalism in general. And what happens is really fascinating. It's almost like the flu delivers an enormous present to the election, to Sinn Féin in the general election in December 1918.
Could I bring John Gibney in on that, John? Let's move on to the 1918 general election. So what happened in Kildare? Kildare was two constituencies, North and South. What happened in Kildare?
Well, I suppose you could say it was a microcosm of, or reflects what happened nationally, in that Sinn Féin displaced the Irish Parliamentary Party. But it's worth having a look at a couple of things within that are kind of striking. Whether they're particular to Kildare or not is another question. But there were two Westminster parliamentary seats for two constituencies in Kildare, like Kildare North and Kildare South, which I suppose still survives in the Dáil representation in the county. And both of these would have been held up until 1918 by the Irish Parliamentary Party, and have been held by nationalist candidates of one stripe or another, usually parliamentary party, but occasionally the Irish National League, from the 1880s onwards, when the constituency had been forced divided into two. Now, the two incumbent MPs were kind of in Kildare North. You had a chap called John O'Connor, who was a former Fenian, member of the Parliamentary Party, originally from Cork, and then the MP in the south of the county would have been Dennis Kilbride, originally from Laois, and neither one of them had actually contested an election in over a decade. I mean, the general elections in 1906, the two general elections of 1910, they were both elected unopposed throughout those elections. And, you know, even O'Connor had been elected by in a by-election in 1905. So it doesn't seem to be the case that he necessarily had, you know, much experience of electioneering by the parliamentary party, at least in terms of trying to argue a case against an opponent. Another point that will be worth making, and it's a point that I think it's kind of interesting when you look at both of the IPP MPs. Both of them had cut their teeth in the land war. Both of them had a record of agrarian agitation. You know, I mean, Kilbride had organised rent strikes, you know, during the land war. But both of them had sat from, neither one was from Kildare, and both of them had sat from multiple constituencies. Kilbride had been an MP for Galway and Kerry, as well as ending up as an MP for Kildare. O'Connor had sat for a seat in Tipperary, and even before he became an MP, the MP for Kildare North, he was penciled in to take a parliamentary seat in Meath, except that he got into, there was a hint of a possible scandal involving a divorce case with his wife, which, to avoid the prospect of another, you know, divorce scandal around a divorce in the parliamentary party, he apparently withdrew his name from contention, but then when the vacancy arose in Kildare, he went into it. Now, that does suggest candidates being parachuted into constituencies around the country, which isn't actually unusual for the practice of the parliamentary party. But it's striking to think that when they were both defeated and unseated in 1918, they were both defeated by local candidates, in the sense that Donald O'Buckley, who won Kildare North, we'd heard about him again, and if you trace him forward into the 1930s, you'd hear more about him in a different context. I mean, O'Buckley was from Maynooth. Art O'Connor, and we just heard mention of a sister there from Ida. I mean, he was from Selbridge. And I kind of wonder, was, even aside from the swing towards Sinn Féin that would have been happening, was there a certain amount, could they have tapped into more local networks to mobilise people?
John, would these, sorry to come across you, was the 1918 election contested in both constituencies?
In both constituencies, yeah.
But this is, and the other thing that strikes me, this goes against the trend. I mean, in other constituencies, it tends to be Sinn Féin that parachutes people in, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Whereas this is the opposite.
Yeah. And it wasn't an uncommon practice to parachute people in at all. It's just striking that the two victorious Sinn Féin candidates actually came from within the constituency. Now, like every other constituency in the country, the electorate would have dramatically expanded since previous elections. I mean, Kildare South went from having just about an electorate of about 5,000 to an electorate of over 14,000 by 1918. So you had more people, younger people, women over 30 would have been able to vote. And you do see there were traces of kind of militancy and separatism, you know, at an earlier stage, even before the election. I mean, at Wolfetone's, the pilgrimage to Bowdenstown, got I mentioned earlier on, but the pilgrimage to Bowdenstown in June 1918 had a very explicit separatist complexion and involved crowds of up to 5,000, which was a big number, even by the standards of that occasion. So, I mean, you could say that, you know, it does reflect the fact that Sinn Féin were on the march, but the scene, it just, there is, you're right in pointing out, there's a striking local dynamic there, and I wonder, did people of O'Connor and Buccleuch, were they able to mobilise people more effectively, or were the parliamentary party opponents simply inexperienced in electioneering, or was it a mixture of the two that brought them success? Because they won by very, very striking margins.
James, if you need comment on that, just very quick comment on that local angle that John has identified.
Yeah, this was the first time that local people had been actually elected in their own constituency for a very, very long time, as John was saying. And the margins, as he says, were quite high. Donal na Buccleuch polls 5,979 against the sitting John O'Connor of 2,772. And it was the largest majority ever in North Kildare. And in South Kildare, Arthur O'Connor was elected with 7,104 votes, with Dennis Kilbride only receiving 1,545, giving O'Connor a majority of 5,559. This was, as John was saying, quite unique. And Arthur O'Connor is in, as Ida rightly says, he's after being arrested in the German plot, and he's in Dartmoor jail at the time. He doesn't even sit in the first Dáil because he's in hospital, recovering from the flu. When the Dáil sits in January 1919, O'Buccleuch is there, but Art is not.
Just very quickly, Fionnuala, if I go to you, because the Irish Parliamentary Party had opposed votes for women, and women over 30 had the vote in 1918. I've asked this question several times, right? I mean, is there any anecdotal evidence that the women were waiting in the long grass for Redmond and his party?
Yeah, well, certainly there was a lot of hostility between suffragists and Redmond. You know, the Redmond's hostility to or reluctance to support women getting the vote was something that came up constantly. And when, you know, among the Hanashi Skeffington sort of group, the Irish Women's Franchise League, when the war broke out, you know, one of the reasons for not wanting to support it is that they've no reason to show loyalty to Redmond. That, you know, these are the men who inflicted the Cat and Mouse Act on them, who imprisoned them, you know, and it's just saying, well, if you support the war, you know, what will you get in return? We'll go back to the subjection of women. And so there's, you know, the argument was suffrage before everything else. Now, initially, they're quite sort of cautious about Sinn Féin as well, about the Irish Volunteers. And, you know, the Cumann na mBan is criticised by the suffragists as being an animated collecting box for the Irish Volunteers. And it really takes Easter Rising and the centering of women in that, you know, women being included, the proclamation being addressed to Irish men, Irish women, women's suffrage being explicitly mentioned in that, equal opportunities for men and women. That, you know, this brings about a change of opinion. And it means then that, you know, Sinn Féin becomes sort of the obvious party of choice for many suffragists. And many of them do get involved in it over the subsequent years. Now, obviously, there's lots of pro-Redmond, pro-Irish Parliamentary Party women involved in the by-elections and in the December 1918 election, most notoriously, of course, the separation women who are quite actively involved in opposing Sinn Féin and get involved in quite violent activities there as well. Sinn Féin, you know, make a real effort to get out the vote among women. Same with the Ulster Unionists, similar things happened there. You know, really pushing to make sure that all women who are likely to vote for them, you know, have the opportunity to vote, that they know what to do, that they're ready for that. And so, you know, there is very much a gendered dimension to all of this. The Irish Parliamentary Party hadn't really made that effort. And of course, you know, the women, I say separation women, soldiers, dependents, who are sort of, you know, very visibly supporting them. Many of them don't actually have the vote in 1918. Many of them are below the age of 30, don't meet the property requirements and so forth. And they're almost like they become an embarrassment to the Irish Parliamentary Party. They're not the face that they want to put forward. And they associate them with the British Army, you know, and with conscription and so forth. So they're getting support from women that they don't necessarily want, and not
the ones that have the vote. Yeah,
exactly.
Now, I just realized I used the wrong metaphor from asking that question. Of course, there's no long grass in Kildare; it's all short grass. But anyway, moving on, James, because the British, of course, ignore the mandate of the 1918 election, and armed struggle begins in 1919, slowly at first. Now, how long does it take before armed activity begins to become apparent in Kildare?
Yeah, it takes a while. Like, I mean, the Irish Volunteers are reorganised in Kildare, like throughout the country, in 1917. But then there's the conscription crisis is then in 1918, and the Irish Volunteers get a huge amount of recruits. And as soon as the crisis is over, many of these fade away, and you're left with a core of recruits or volunteers within the county. But it doesn't really begin to kick off in Kildare until 1920. Really, in 1920, then it's with the burning of barracks and the attacks on courthouses and income tax offices and all that, in around April 1920, when the general strike is called with the hunger strike in Mountjoy. And then with the burning of the barracks, the order to burn evacuated barracks in throughout the country. And in Kildare, there's a total of 26 barracks. And by August of 1920, there's only six of them operating. The rest of them have been abandoned by the RIC and then subsequently burned by the Irish Volunteers. Several courthouses are burned in right even beside the Curragh, in close proximity to the Curragh. Even the police barracks and the courthouse are burned. And it's here then that the volunteers begin to start becoming active in Kildare. But it's very low-key in violence-wise anyway, because there's very few attacks on the RIC, absolutely no attacks on the British Army whatsoever, and only several attacks on the RIC.
That's hardly surprising, though. You're not going to attack a
No, this is not possible.
Armed.
No.
What about the obviously, one thing just struck me is The British military establishment, though, would be a potential supply of weapons, right? Any attempts made to get their hands on British Army ordnance?
The real way to get their hands on British Army ordnance is they actually buy revolvers and weapons off the British soldiers themselves. A lot of the British soldiers sell weapons for drink money, basically. And it's where the volunteers in Kildare pick up a lot of weaponry is from. Soldiers, serving soldiers who sell off their weapons. And that's mostly how they collect.
James, would I be right in assuming a lot of that, those weapons would end up in Dublin, though? They might end up used somewhere else.
Yeah, they were not used in Kildare. Most of them would have went on to GHQ, but they would have been held, a lot of them would have been held in Kildare then as well. Revolvers and that would have been used. There's very little use for rifles unless you're doing large-scale ambushes. Probably the only time rifles would have been used would have been in maybe the attack at Maynooth. They weren't used in Barra House, where there was two volunteers killed, and in Kill, where there was two RIC men killed. There was only shotguns or revolvers were used at that. So they were all the time under strength and all the time without any weaponry, basically.
Now, we now have that fantastic resource that the Eunice Halpin and Dáil Mhór Cóiríonn said, the debt of the Irish Revolution. So, James, just give me the figure. What's the figure of the debt toll in the War of Independence in Kildare?
The debt toll in the War of Independence in Kildare is only 9 people were killed. And then there's a couple of other people killed in other parts of the country then serving RIC men or volunteers involved in other parts of the country.
But where does that put Kildare on the league table, if I might call it that, in terms of per capita?
Very low. I think it was 1.1 or something like that. It was quite low. Anyway, it's one of the lowest in the country.
Can I bring in John Gibney on this, John? How does that compare with the rest of Leinster? Now, let's leave Dublin out of the picture because that's a particular case. But accepting Dublin, how does Kildare compare with the rest of Leinster?
Broadly speaking, apart from Longford, it's not a million miles out. Leinster overall was regarded by the Republican leadership as a bit of a disappointment, that it could have been more active. And, even within that, you'd have A lot depended on, say, activity on the ground. Like even in Longford, which was easily the most active county in Leinster, there was a distinction you had between the north and the south of the county, because in the north of the county you would have people like Sean McGowan be very active, a kind of proactive volunteer leadership, whereas in the south apparently they were probably, it's been, I think Marie Coleman suggested, were kind of probably residual sympathies for the old parliamentary party that kind of impeded the growth of republicanism in the south of the county. But Leinster as a whole wasn't that militant. And even there's a thing in that David Fitzpatrick calculated. He did a calculation of membership of the IRA per 1,000 male Catholics in the county as a kind of metric of guessing, of trying to figure out how active the actual IRA's organisation might be on the ground in 1921. And Kildare would have been the second lowest in Leinster. It's only 1.03 male Catholics in the county per 1,000 were members of the IRA. Wicklow would have been the only one lower than that. But Leinster as a whole wasn't necessarily, I mean, it certainly wasn't Munster. It wasn't seen as active. And even within, Longford stands out, but even within that, there's regional variations. So, I mean, it looks to me like, Leinster as a whole wasn't particularly active. So if Kildare
was a typical Leinster county.
It's a typical Leinster county, yeah.
Now, sometimes terrain is used as an excuse, inverted commas here, right? But I mean, James, if I bring you in on this, because we've just done a couple of hedge schools on Wicklow, right? Perfectly suited to guerrilla warfare.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the numbers are just as low. So leadership, going back to Sean McKeown in North Longford, leadership seems to be the key thing rather than terrain.
Yeah, it's really personalities that drive the revolution. And if you look at most of the counties, they have prominent personalities that actually ran what was happening in their area and that. And Kildare doesn't have a personality like that. They had Donal O'Buchan, of course, in Maynooth, but he was 55 in 1916, so he's beyond going out into the field and leading men. You have the likes of Jim Dunn in Kill, who is only very young at the time. He's only in his early, he's only around 20 in 1920, and he wants to form a flying column in the Kill area of men on the run, and the Kill area would have been quite active, but GHQ won't allow them to form a flying column because it's going to disrupt communications coming from the south and coming from the west. So they're not allowed to form a flying column in the area. Now, he is raring to go in ways and that, and he becomes very, very prominent in the Civil War. He gets to run his own flying column in the Civil War, and he's one of the most active people in the county during the Civil War. And the same in North County Kildare as well. Patrick Mullaney, a school teacher from Leixlip, and he's part of the Meath North Kildare Active Service unit or flying column. And again, they're pretty active just towards the end of the War of Independence. But again, in the Civil War, he forms his own active service unit, a flying column. And between him and Dunn, they're probably the two most active ones in County Kildare during the Civil War, which the death toll then in the county, unfortunately, goes way up to 45 or something compared to 9 in the War of Independence.
Well, we'll have further head schools on that.
That'll be very interesting.
Are we talking about the wrong thing here? Because this has come up again and again, right? That really the armed struggle is only the tip of the iceberg, right? Because meanwhile, you have the whole counter-state, you've got the local elections in 1920, the setting up of Dáil Court. So how does Kildare figure on that side of things, James?
Yeah, they're pretty successful there. And again, just going back to the military angle as well, they're pretty successful on this, what is termed small jobs, which is trenching of roads, blockading roads and breaking communications and breaking bridges and all that. They're quite successful at that. After
And communications are a key thing in Kildare, given its location.
Yeah, of course, the intelligence war, we can talk about that in a few minutes then as well. And this is where Kildare excels. But as you were saying, like Kildare County Council elections in 1920, of the 29 people elected, 28 of them are either Sinn Féin or Labour. So they begin to dominate the county councils, urban councils all around the whole county and that. And many of the IRA men were either members of the Labour Party or Sinn Féin. So many of the council members were Labour or Sinn Féin, and are very strong in the urban areas. A county councillor, Michael Smith, was commandant of a Kildare battalion, and Tom Harris, also a county councillor, he was commandant of the 2nd Kildare battalion. And Smith was a Labour councillor. He was town councillor. He was also secretary of the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. So Naas UDC and Naas Town Commission are dominated by Sinn Féin. And they decided to propose that all towns are to be known as their Irish names. Then Naas becomes Naasnarí, Newbridge becomes Drogheda-Nua, other councils then follow suit. In Selbridge, the council unanimously decided that no list of ratepayers, details of rates or valuation books, salaries or wages by the councils would be revealed to what they termed British agents. Every possible obstacle is placed in the way of the British government for collecting taxes and rates and that. And the same with the health boards and the poor law unions and that. So they're quite successful in that. And again, in Republican courts, to set up Republican courts then all around the county. And it's really a rival system to replace British Crown courts. So from early 1920, a new system emerges consisting of parish courts, powers to deal with claims of under £10, and district courts for the more serious offences. And the Republican courts operated in the main urban areas, slowly began to replace the Crown system, arbitrating in local systems and dealing out a system of what is probably termed fairer justice than the British system. So,
you mentioned the intelligence war, right? So, what do you mean by that? What's Kildare's role in that?
Yeah, well, it really begins when Sean Kavanagh comes to Naas. He's a Gaelic League teacher. He comes to teach in Naas, and he makes contact with a guy working in Naas RIC barracks, Jeremiah Marr, who's a constable there. And he's passing on information. He's passing on top level information to Sean Kavanagh, who's bringing it directly to GHQ. And it includes the cipher, this coded cipher that is broken by Collins's network of spies and that, because of the information that they receive from Naas. So between Jeremiah Marr and Sean Kavanagh, a lot of the information coming from the south is being deciphered before it gets to Dublin. And there's RIC men working in Newbridge barracks. And then even when Jeremiah Mark becomes under suspicion, and his replacement then is Paddy Casey, and he's another intelligence operative for the IRA.
But of course, just clarify, when did they break the cipher? When is this happening?
This is in the summer of 1920. And I think this is the cipher that Terence McSweeney has in his possession when he's arrested in Cork.
And, can I bring John Gibney in here, John? Because in the previous head school we did on Dublin, you explained to us about the reorganisation of the Castle's whole intelligence network in the summer of 1920, which is hardly a coincidence here. In other words, like, was the Castle aware that their cipher was broken, and where did that figure in their whole rejigging of their intelligence system?
That's a cool question. I honestly don't know. Whether that was a particular...
Well, James has thrown this into the mix here. It's something that has only occurred to me now, but it's an obvious one, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what does sound obvious now that you mention it.
But John, just recap on what was happening from on the British side in response to this.
Well, the British, I mean, in kind of March into May 1920, the British had kind of, I mean, essentially once partition had been effectively formalised, they began to divert their attention to dealing with Sinn Féin. And they did overhaul their government in Dublin Castle in the early part of the year, which they felt was essentially not fit for purpose. And essentially from the early part of 1920, the British were kind of opening the door to having some kind of negotiations with whoever represented Irish people, which is paraphrasing the comment that Lloyd George made on the same topic. But they also, I mean, this was also at the same time that, you know, they began to recruit paramilitary forces within a few months of the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act. So the two went hand in hand. And, the British were increasing their oppression throughout 1920 anyway. Breaking the cipher, as James pointed out, that's obviously something that's worth considering, you know. The British were doing that anyway, and they were doing it across the country. I mean, it did seem to, there was a school of thought within the British administration, both military and political, that the thing that had to be done with Sinn Féin and the IRA was to crush it as best they could.
I tell you, as I'm just looking at the time here, I want to just go back to James to wrap up on this, James. Just could you give us a sense then, what was the state of play in the county at the time of the truce in terms of the balance of forces on either side?
Yeah, like I just mentioning just the intelligence world, not forgetting Ned Bry from Matangan, who was, of course, in Dublin, one of Collins's main spy in the DMP. But getting back to the state of play at the beginning of the truce and that, like an internment camp, a huge internment camp had been opened in Kildare on the 1st of March in the Corrie camp with about 1,500 men interned there. From all over the 5th Division area, or the Midlands area, as it was called, which included Dublin and most of the Midland counties. So around April 1921, the IRA is reorganised on a regular basis, like a regular army, based on the British one, of brigades and divisions and that. And this is when the IRA becomes more adept at taking on the British, and violence escalates. And it's then that Kildare is getting more organised, and this is where all the small jobs come into it, the trenching of roads and communications and that. But by the time the truce has come, everybody is getting more organised. The whole country is beginning to get more organised, and Richard Mulcahy is sending out congratulations to all the other counties that are really coming on board in that period of time. But when the truce is signed then in July 1921, most of the internees in the camp expect to be released, but it doesn't happen. Of course, negotiations are going on then, which culminates in the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. But in September 1921, there's a huge breakout from the current internment camp, a tunnel. There's actually two tunnels running at the same time, the Dublin Brigade Tunnel and what was known as the Tullamore Tunnel, or the Rabbit Warren, another tunnel being devised by men from the West. One of them had been a tunneller had worked in the Erigna mine, so knew how to dig a tunnel properly. And this was used for both the 25 men from the Dublin Brigade and 25 men from the West who escaped this tunnel. About 54 in total escaped. But the point I'm trying to make is that every one of those 54 men reported back for duty, because the IRA was expecting that the truce was going to break down and the war would continue. And within the camps, the internment camps, there was a lot of dissension the way the treaty negotiations were going. One of those men prominent in the current internment camp was Tom Bean from Ratangan, who had been arrested after 1916 and had been jailed in England and had been pretty active in Kildare afterwards. Now, he prophesied in the autumn of 1921 that if the negotiations went the way the war going, that there would be a civil war. And he is one of the controversial victims of the civil war in Kildare the following year.
James, you have teed things up nicely for the next series of Hedge Schools, which we will be convening over the next year or two. But I tell you, this has been a very interesting discussion, because we've answered a few questions, but we've raised a few as well, which we can come back to in the future. Yeah. But listen, I'd like to thank our panelists here today, James Durney, John Gibney, Ida Milne, and Fionnuala Walsh. And our next Hedge School, which will be posted at the end of this month, will be on spies and informers. So listeners, I hope you can tune in for that.